The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Good morning, comrades. Recently, Time magazine did a cover piece entitled Rise of the Strongman. They wrote, quote, "In response to the social upheavals of the 1960s, Hollywood produced a series of highly popular angry man crime dramas in the 1970s. These are the stories of vigilantes and renegade cops played by the likes of Clint Eastwood, like in Dirty Harry, or Charles Bronson in Death Wish, who push past weak-willed bureaucrats, corrupt politicos, and political correctness to restore justice in violent times. These are men who never let law undermine order. In every region of the world, changing times have boosted public demand for more muscular, assertive leadership. These tough-talking populists promise to protect us from them. And depending on who's talking, them can mean corrupt elite, grasping poor, foreigners, members of racial, ethnic, or religious minorities, disloyal politicians, bureaucrats, bankers, judges, reporters. Out of this divide, a new archetype of leaders emerged. We're now in the strongman era," unquote. One of the strongmen that was featured was Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. Upon his election in May 2016, Duterte unleashed a so-called war on drugs, which so far has officially killed 4,279 people in what the government calls drug-related shootouts with police. However, the reality is probably far more horrifying, as human rights groups fear that the actual fatalities could be as high as 22,000, most of which being committed by vigilantes, most of whom are suspected with working with the police, which is why President Duterte has been referred to as Duterte Harry. Despite the bloody crackdown and the international condemnation against it, Duterte has remained very popular amongst Filipinos. For the first 6 months of his presidency, he enjoyed 90% approval ratings. And even today, even though he called God an SOB in a heavily Catholic country, he still enjoys a 70% approval rating. Like the election of Donald Trump, the surprise ascendancy of Duterte has raised a number of questions for the left. Is this disruption or a continuation of mainstream politics? Why are right-wing populists able to gain significant sections of working-class support? Which the Time magazine piece, I think, illustrates that this is not just an American or a Philippine problem. How do we get back to normal? Do we even want to go back to normal? And when the left is weak, how do we fight back? So while there are many similarities between Trump and Duterte, they are not the same. Both are sexist, loudmouthed, have their own reality TV shows, and also, as being exposed by The Intercept, they share this very bizarre midnight phone conversation bromance. But they are different. For one thing, unlike Trump, Duterte actually has experience running a public office. Second, Duterte won the popular vote. And also, by some accounts, and probably most frightening, Duterte has actually murdered people personally. In many respects, what the Philippine working class face is worse than what we face in the United States, which is why it's important for us to come to grips with how Duterte was able to take advantage of the political despair of working class people and what it means for struggles for the future. It is especially important as American socialists to learn about the Philippines, not just because it was a U.S. colony for decades, but because our ruling class has always made sure that this island nation has been within their sphere of influence, often with very deadly consequences. In the course of the talk, I'm going to explain Duterte's rise, how he is reshaping the Philippines economically and politically, and challenges facing the left. Duterte is the son of a powerful local politician and began his political career as a prosecutor. Through his father's influence, he became the mayor of Davao City in a reign that spanned a total of 22 years. There was intervals between that because he actually got elected to Congress once. One thing that is important to know about Davao City is that it is located in Mindanao, which is probably the most conflict-ridden island in the Philippines. It's experienced ongoing insurgencies by a few militant Islamic groups and the New People's Army, which is the armed wing of the Communist Party. To have stability in a city in this region is very difficult without some use of force. Davao is the third largest city in the Philippines, and Duterte ran it with an iron fist. Though today it is considered to be the safest city in Southeast Asia, it's because of the death squad nicknamed the Davao Death Squad, or DDS, which murdered hundreds of people and became the recognized authority of the streets. The squad would routinely hunt down dealers, drug dealers, petty criminals, and street children. One report by the Coalition Against Summary Execution documented 814 death squad killings in Davao City between 98 and early 2009, the majority of the victims being the urban poor. To be clear, there's not any hard evidence linking Duterte with the death squads. When asking whether or not he had a hand in them, he flatly denies it. However, he has made hints and offhand remarks that he might be responsible. More damning has been the testimony of a former DDS hitman and a former Davao police officer that testified that the death squads were being run by him. However, Duterte has continued to deny their existence or any involvement with the group, but he made it very clear that he did support vigilante killings of suspected criminals. He certainly was the beneficiary of the killings, as it brought order to the city and got him lots of respect and political connections and business connections during his reign. Personally, I think it's actually very hard to believe that business people and politicians would actually take Duterte seriously if he was in charge of a city with a death squad that was just running on the loose without him having any control over it. So I think they wouldn't take him seriously unless they actually knew that he was the one cleaning up the streets, for lack of a better phrase. How did this infamous yet relatively unconnected politician ascend to the highest office in the country? To understand why, I think you need to understand the current shape of Philippine capitalism and how the liberal elite failed to meet the needs of the working class since the People Power Revolution of 1986. To explain that, I need to talk about how capitalist rule developed in the Philippines. So I'm gonna go over 500 years of Philippine history in just a few seconds, so you should buckle your seatbelts. Very quickly, the Spanish conquered the Philippines in 1565 and then ruled it as a colony for 333 years. And under the Spanish, colonialism developed a class of land-owning elite. Spanish colonizers turned pre-colonial chiefs and nobles, together with mestizos, mixed race with Chinese merchants, into a privileged class which accumulated land, wealth, and power. Under American colonialism, these elites had their power molded into a bicameral system of government. While America's imperialist war and violent occupation killed upwards of a million people, many of these elites still prospered greatly. What's more, the occupation, while heavily favoring American interests, also brought industrialization to the Philippines. This allowed a burgeoning bourgeois class to rise and reshape the ways and methods that the traditional land-owning families grew or maintained their wealth and power. The type of capitalism that ruled the Philippines has been characterized in many different ways, but I think the most apt description is what's called elite democracy. So you have a mix of the descendants of the landed aristocracy, you have the nouveau riche from business and industry, and then you have kind of a mix of the two. The elite, new and old, dominate the country's main political parties, which are almost identical in ideology and program. Sound familiar? Knowing that access to the government apparatus and its resources is vital to maintaining their hold on power and wealth, they often resort to patronage, or what is known as the three G's, which is guns, goons, and gold. Although today now it's four G's, it's guns, goons, gold, and gigabytes, you know, for social media. Factions of the elite, when in government, endeavor to extract as much as they can from their positions. Of course, before and after the colonial period, there was ongoing resistance with revolts by peasants, agricultural workers, oppressed minorities, and a small but combative working class. In the late 60s and early 70s, there was a growing radicalization. Competition within the ruling class put strains on society, and in response, workers, students, and peasants started to mobilize. The most pronounced threat was probably the armed insurgency by the Maoist New People's Army, which broke out in 1969 and is still going into today. So today, it's actually one of the longest running armed communist insurgencies in the world. The dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos arose in 1972 in an attempt to both prevent the growth of the left and also to rein in the right in order to allow the state to become the most developed country in Asia. It upset the decades-long domination of the traditional elites by concentrating more power within the state and relied on a loyal base of technocrats, loyal cronies, and the military. Instead of becoming the most developed economy, it became one of the most depressed, as the Marcos's exuberant lifestyle put the treasury in $10 billion worth of debt, and that debt is still being paid up into today to international creditors. 14 years of martial law and dictatorship was finally overthrown in 1986 by a mass uprising known as People Power. People Power is a very, very important part of people's history and socialist history and working class history, so I'm not going to do any justice, but there's a few things I wanted to point out. So I'm just going to go through a very abbreviated version of this. Ninoy Aquino was a senator from the Lee family, and he was also Marcos's greatest critic. He was jailed by the regime, and he was also sentenced to death by a military court. But he was allowed to leave the Philippines for the U.S. for medical treatment, but on the condition that he remain in exile. Ninoy decided to return to the United States and snub the exile in 1983. He was immediately gunned down by the military when he arrived in the airport. His assassination sparked a mass movement which coalesced around his wife, Cory Aquino, who ran for president in 1986. Like the previous elections, voter fraud, tampering, and intimidation were widespread. But this time, the vast majority of people knew that Cory actually won. When Marcos decided to declare victory anyway, Cory called for a mass movement and also a general strike at the end of February. But before that strike could occur, a group of military officers organized under the Reform Armed Forces Movement occupied a base and declared the Marcos administration an illegitimate government. The reason why this group was formed is because the government was completely inept when it tried to crush the ongoing communist insurgency. Another major grievance was the fact that there was virtually no room for advancement by anyone in the officer corps because the Marcoses only appointed people that they trusted. And at critical points, soldiers lacked basic equipment, weapons, and support during vital operations. So this is why they finally had enough and decided that they needed a new government. To defend the officers from being slaughtered by loyalist forces, hundreds of thousands of people blocked the main road leading to the base. And then all over the country, protests took over major cities, and then strikes started to shut down key sections of the economy. The mass mobilizations prevented the officer rebellion from being crushed, and it also won more and more sections of the military to their cause, as well as gave more and more room for the working class and the oppressed to actually take over cities and their workplaces. So after 3 days of struggle, Marcos was finally forced to leave the country by an American-supplied helicopter. As a result, Cory Aquino was sworn in as president, but capitalism remained very much intact. So despite some important legislation that curbed government power and provided limited land reform, elite rule was reestablished. To this day, 70% of the Philippine legislators are actually part of some political dynasty. Only now, neoliberalism became the political and economic agenda for the next three decades. Of course, this was not completely unopposed. There has been ongoing resistance to this, the most obvious example being the movement to oust the corrupt president, Joseph Estrada, known as People Power II, in 2001. But the revolutionary left was unable to make a major breakthrough with the traditional parties completely dominating the government. So traditional parties is what's known as trapos or trapo politics. I thought trapo meant traditional politics, but it's actually a word to describe a rag that's used to clean things, but instead of actually cleaning, it's spreading more and more dirt around your house. So that's what people know as trapo politics. So under trapo politics, the economy expanded and became more competitive internationally, but the fortunes of the Philippine working class did not improve. While millions still live in utter poverty, with millions more facing stagnant standard of living, it's within this context that Duterte rose to power. Duterte is seen as an effective leader that can get things done in a country where the government and mainstream politics feel disconnected from everyday Filipinos. And this right-wing populism is the key to Duterte's electoral success and his current popularity. As political activist Walden Bellows said, quote, Duterte's railing against corruption and poverty, his obvious disdain for the rich, and above all, his coming across as one of you guys that acted as a magnet to workers, urban poor, peasants, and the lower middle class, unquote. So people were willing to shake things up. They wanted to take a chance in Duterte because trapo politics brought them nothing for three decades. However, just like the rise of Trump, there are several false explanations that arose in the aftermath of the election, very much like here. The most important of these can be summarized like this. Desperate working class and poor people were duped by fanatical populists, so any hope that the left can actually fight back on its own principles is lost. And I want to argue against this. First of all, not all Filipinos voted for Duterte. In total, Duterte got 16 million votes, which is still 6 million more than the next runner-up. But in the end, that's only about 29% of the entire electorate, and almost half the country doesn't actually vote. So I think Jen Rush, in one of her sessions, she said that if none of the above actually ran for president in 2016, none of the above would actually win. The same applies to the Philippines. Second, and most importantly, Duterte's actual base is not the poor, it's actually the middle class and the rich. While it takes votes to win an election, to run a viable campaign takes money. Altogether, $7.5 million was raised for Duterte's campaign, and 90% of that was raised by 13 individuals. Less than 1% of campaign funds actually came from small donations. Duterte's coalition consists of prominent businessmen from Davao City, traditional politicians that got snubbed by one of the political dynasties, and the new middle class, which consists of call center workers, Uber drivers, overseas Filipino workers, and probably most importantly, the national police. So this wasn't a revolt by the poor, but a revolt of the new middle class that suffered from the lack of basic public services, endured the horrendous land and air traffic, feared the breakdown of peace and order, and silently witnessed their tax money siphoned off by corruption despite decades of promises of improved governance. Now, this is not to diminish the swaths of support that Duterte received at minimum by millions of working class Filipinos, or the overwhelming and ongoing support that he continues to enjoy in public opinion. It does, however, break through the simplistic narrative that the Philippine masses as a whole were just duped and brainwashed. Instead, we see that an important block of the upper classes was able to take advantage of genuine discontent of millions of people and were victorious because the left was unable to provide an alternative. A crucial question that has been raised is, does Duterte signal a disruption or a continuation of trapo politics? When looking at Duterte's long-term vision, I think we can clearly see that the mainstream politics and the elites, it is absolutely a disruption. Duterte's vision is to remake the Philippines as a strong independent colony. Economy. Ooh. There's debates about that too. So his vision is modernization through industrialization for the good and, oh my God, that rhymes. Okay, sorry about that. Okay. It's still true. Modernization through industrialization for the good of the nation. And in order to make this happen, if authoritarian measures are necessary to make that so, then he's totally willing to do it. And I think his model for this is the Marcos dictatorship. Duterte is a proud admirer of Marcos, which is illustrated not just by his words, but by his actions. In November of 2016, Duterte had Marcos's body buried in the National Heroes Cemetery. Before this, he was kept in a refrigerator by his wife in Hawaii. It's bizarre. But now they brought him back and put him in the traditional burial place of Philippine war heroes and past leaders. It's hard to imagine what this means or how this would resonate like in an American context, but the best thing I can think of is if somehow they got the corpse of Jefferson Davis, the head of the Confederacy, and then decided to bury him next to John F. Kennedy. You know, something like that. I guess that could happen under Trump. Who knows? So in addition to placing him in this place of honor, Duterte also has chosen not to participate in the annual People Power commemorations. This is a really big deal in the Philippines. So every year, the entire nation celebrates the People Power Revolution, with the entire political establishment paying lip service with massive marches and rallies. So Duterte not participating is not just some petty snub to a pivotal historical moment that he just doesn't like. It's actually a struggle against memory. He's trying to kill the lived experience of millions that struggled against the dictatorship of Marcos because it contradicts his vision for the Philippines. And also, it continues his narrative that the revolution led to nothing but 30 years of tribal politics that did nothing for the people. For the capitalist class as a whole, I think they could give a damn about the People Power Revolution. For them, it's political theater to placate the masses. But the elites have entrenched interests and may not be keen on Duterte's grand plans if it does not benefit them or take their interests into consideration. And this is why Duterte's populism is so dangerous. His condemnation of the powerful works to undermine some of the established elites that are based in Manila, which is the capital of the country. And he's also aligning with a section of the rising elites from Davao City and other islands like Mindanao, which is from the south. He attacks the elites in order to reign over them. And the war on drugs has been instrumental in this move to consolidate power. The war against drugs is absolutely a war on poor people and the working class. Because not just because they're the victims, but because they're the targets. Not just the targets of the killings, but also when you say that criminals are the main reason that your livelihood and your society is in dire straits, you're putting the entire responsibility of the dysfunction of your society on poor people instead of the folks that have been running the country. But it's also reined in the ruling class. The popularity of the campaign has scared all the Trapo parties to fall in line to support Duterte, essentially giving him support from the entire legislature. So this reining in has been so effective that Duterte has been able to defeat his biggest opponents. One, he engineered the removal of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Maria Lourdes Serrano, the first woman to hold that position. Two, his biggest political opponent, Senator Leyla de Lima, he charged her with corruption. And this is exactly after she gathered testimony in front of the Congress of the hitman and the police officer that identified Duterte as head of the DDS, or the Davao Death Squad. Another section of the state that has been disrupted by Duterte's agenda is the military. So ever since the American occupation, the armed forces of the Philippines has always had a very close relationship with U.S. forces. In the post-colonial period, the U.S. has been essential in the arming and training of Philippine forces, has given them direct support in their counterinsurgency operations, and have been very close advisors for the growing tensions between the Philippine Navy and the Chinese Navy as they encroach further and further into Philippine territory in the South China Sea. So as you can imagine, when Duterte, when visiting Beijing, announced that he was not only going to break away from the U.S., but expel all U.S. troops and reorient his entire foreign policy to favor China, that this rattled the generals and the entire officer corps. One event that actually healed relations between Duterte and the military was the Siege of Marawi. So, between May and October of last year, Islamic militants that aligned themselves with ISIS took over the town of Marawi in Mindanao. The fighting left the town in ruins and killed over 1,000 people, most of which were the insurgents themselves and Philippine armed forces, and they're with some civilian casualties. Throughout the conflict, Duterte gave the military's full support and even diverted funds from essential government projects, including the Philippine Olympic Committee, in order to support this military campaign. He also shielded the military from public accusations of human rights abuses during the fighting. So from the standpoint of the generals, at the height of this armed crisis, their president had their back and let them do their fighting while shielding them from national and international human rights concerns. The siege also allowed Duterte to declare martial law on the entire island and even got it extended to the end of this year. So this did mend some fences. However, there's still ongoing tensions because as Duterte is trying to curry more and more favor from China, the Chinese Navy is still at times harassing Philippine fishermen and even stealing their catches. And some of these incidents actually all happened only just a few weeks ago. So for the political establishment and the Trapos and the military, the Duterte administration has been a disruption to the elite democracy that has ruled in the post-Marcos period. For the working class and the oppressed, it's still a continuation of exploitation and rule from above. Recently, Duterte has announced an ambitious $180 billion infrastructure plan, which he calls Build, Build, Build. This is actually desperately needed. The Philippines ranks as 97th in the world in terms of infrastructure, and right now the economy has seen a 6% annual growth rate for the last few years, so they're actually hoping to capitalize on it while the times are good. And to fund the project, they're actually hoping to get more investment and aid from China, and so far they've secured $7.8 billion. The government has also passed a massive tax reform act to raise revenue from the upper classes while cutting a break for the ones that live below the poverty line. There's absolutely no reason to believe that these measures are actually going to help the poor. The last time ambitious national projects like this were planned was under Marcos, when the funds were siphoned off to his family and their supporters. So even if Duterte resists the temptation of corruption and give his allies lucrative contracts, it's highly unlikely that China will offer aid without steep concessions or conditions. As one example, there's one loan from China that's a $58 million irrigation project. This loan has an interest rate of 2%. Which doesn't sound like very much. If you can get a mortgage on 2%, that's good. But when compared to similar loans that are offered by Japan, for instance, they don't offer a 2% interest rate, they offer a 0.25% interest rate. More important is that it's rare for China to fund massive projects that are not primarily staffed by Chinese workers. So the job prospects for Filipinos in these projects is probably going to be limited. The bottom line is that to really raise the condition of the working class will require good paying, safe jobs, and an expanded social safety net. So far, Duterte has offered nothing concrete, and the new tax law will likely raise the energy costs as well as put an excise tax on things like cars, cooking gas, and sweet beverages. So whatever the poor may save by not having to pay an annual income tax would probably be wiped out with the rising costs of some basic essentials. Duterte has also worked to lower corporate taxes and create special economic zones, which essentially means super exploitative production with virtually no regulation. He also expressed his desire to change the constitution to free restrictions on foreign corporations owning firms in the Philippines. In addition, he has planned to drastically increase military spending, with $5.6 billion being allocated to military modernization over the next few years. And it's likely he's actually going to use this money, as just a week ago they announced that they're going to have a major advance campaign against the New People's Army. So while it's clear that Duterte has shaken up things at the top, it means very little for those at the bottom. And this is ultimately Duterte's weakness. If he does not deliver on economic reforms, he can lose his support amongst the masses. And as explained earlier, his base of support is actually amongst a handful of capitalists, career politicians, and the rising middle class. Their interests are opposed to the interests of the working class, and if he does not deliver to his rich supporters, then his position in the ruling class could be compromised. His position is further weakened by the fact that he lacks a mass movement to serve as a base. Other elite politicians have the benefit of political machines crafted over decades that offer patronage or access to his loyal followers. However, Duterte is working to change this. And of course, the Trapo political machines didn't exactly work in the last election. But if Duterte loses favor and the left is not able to provide an alternative, then it's very possible that these Trapo political machines will fill the void again. So 2 years in office, and there's no improvement in the quality of life of most working class people. Poverty is still rampant, the Philippines is ranked as one of the worst countries in the world to work. And then there's contractualization. Contractualization is a major issue in the Philippines. So this is what we would understand as part-time work or precarious work. So that means that 60% of the Philippines' industrial workforce, or 24 million workers, are still hired on a contractual basis. So you can work in one place for several years, but because legally you're only being hired in increments of a few months, you're not a permanent worker or offered a permanent work with benefits. You're ongoing contractual. 26.4% of the country lives on less than $230 a year. And this is why 6,000 Filipinos leave the country every day seeking out employment abroad, because the job opportunities that would allow for a stable life are practically non-existent. Okay, thank you. What this means is that there is a huge potential for the Philippine working class to reject Duterte's populism and possibly embrace a socialist alternative. However, it is important to grapple with the concrete conditions facing our comrades in the Philippines and not paint a rosy picture if there isn't one. So the left is weak in the Philippines, unfortunately, both politically in terms of size. One reason for this is that the Philippine Communist Party is the most influential left organization in the entire country, as well as its front organizations, which are broadly characterized as being the National Democratic Front. Very early on to Duterte's presidency, they tried very hard to cozy up to Roddy. And there's a reason for this. They were really hoping that they would be able to cut a deal to have hundreds of their political prisoners released and also actually make advances on peace talks. And I think the reason why they were so desperate to do this is that, in my opinion, I think that the communist insurgency is at a dead end. Even though the state has been unable to crush the insurgency for the past 50 years, it's also true that the communists have been unable to actually make an advance forward, and they've been losing membership and support. And at the beginning, this actually seemed a little bit promising, as Duterte actually gave three cabinet positions, which is unheard of. In all the trap of politics and during the Marcos period, no one has ever given cabinet positions to the left. So members of the Communist Party, either openly or not openly, became the head of the Department of Agrarian Reform, the Department of Social Welfare, and also the chair of the National Anti-Poverty Commission. However, I think it's safe to say that taking this position and hoping for the best proved to be an absolute and complete blunder. I think they were so desperate to get forward or make movement on peace talks, they actually did things that I think are inexcusable. So very early on in Duterte's drug war, the CPP actually considered offering Duterte help on his war on drugs. And then also during the siege of Marawi, they toyed with the idea of actually helping Duterte with the New People's Army of crushing the siege if there was progress made during peace talks. So I think this is absolutely inexcusable. You can say it was a mistake or it was a blunder, but what does this do concretely? You're basically offering this terrorist state your guns to help terrorize the Filipino people, and that's not excusable. At the very least, what you can say about it is that it actually put way too much hope in a man that built his political career on murder. Another problem facing the left is that labor unions are on the decline. The Department of Labor showed that in 2003, 20% of wage and salary workers were organized in unions. So 2003, 20%. In 2014, that dropped to 7%. And out of those organized workers, about 20% were covered by collective bargaining agreements. Today, that number's dropped to somewhere around 8%. So this means not just a drop in people that are union members, but also like the actual power of unions or their potential to fight back. The number of strikes is also down by 75% in the first 5 months of this year compared to last year. But the number of strike notices actually went up. So threatening to strike is good, but not going in strike is worse. But there are rays of hope. There are little glimmers of hope. From Duterte's first day in office, there was resistance by small vigils and demonstrations protesting the war on drugs. The biggest protest so far has been when tens of thousands of people took to the streets after it was announced that Marcos's body was secretly buried in the National Cemetery. And even despite all this repression and all this terrorism, this latest May Day, thousands of workers actually came out in demonstrations, like in years past, demanding the end of contractualization and for more union rights. And also last week, transport workers went out on strike and shut down 90% of transportation routes in the Albay province. Yeah. So, okay, great. We can also take hope in the fact that the Filipinos have a very radical history. So despite living under martial law for 14 years, they did overthrow a dictator and then several years later overthrew a corrupt president. The common narrative is that for 14 years before people power, people just remained silent. But this was not the case, as small demonstrations and strikes did chip away at the regime, and those that led these struggles actually became leaders of people power when the struggle actually made a breakthrough. So in the beginning days of people power, I think many people that were not organized looked at their neighbors, coworkers, and classmates and thought, how can these people put up with this for so many years? And after a few years, people finally just had enough. And when they finally saw each other in the streets, facing off against tanks and police, they realized that united, they actually had the power to win. So all that to say is I'm not trying to predict that there's going to be another people power revolution, but I think it's worth noting how before both people power revolutions, everyone thought everything was lost and no one would fight back, and they did. So I think the question is not whether the Filipino people will fight back, but when they do, will the politics of socialism take the lead, or will it be trapo politics?
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.